Hello, friends, and welcome to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. Right now, you are listening to my special series on friendship. On February 5th, Girls Club, the book I wrote with my mom and sister, will be making its way into the world. It is a book about the profound importance of women's friendship. We believe that women flourish in community and that we need each other to grow, emotionally, intellectually, and spiritually. And in a world as lonely as ours, friendship isn't something frivolous. It's a profound thing and a necessary part of our lives. That is why we reached out to women we admire to discuss this profound and important topic. Over the next 3 weeks, I'm excited to share these interviews with you, and I hope that they encourage you as much as they have encouraged me. So make sure to purchase your copy of Girls Club, and then make yourself a cup of tea, sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of Speaking with Joy. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to this final episode in Speaking with Joy on friendship. For the last 2 weeks, you have been absolutely inundated with talk of friendship, of kindred spirits, and of the importance of cultivating friendship in a lonely world. And today, I have the great pleasure of being with a kindred spirit, and we'll be talking about the kindred spirithood that can come from literary friendships. So, Bose, welcome to Speaking with Joy.
Hello.
So, Bose, I feel like before we get started, we should tell people how we met.
How did we meet, Joy?
I think I encountered you through, well, I know I encountered you through Twitter. We are both Twitterites, tweeters, whatever you'd like to call us.
I don't know.
Bose has, what's your account on Twitter?
It's at Sketches by Bose.
At Sketches by Bose, and it's the Library Haunter. Mm-hmm. And I think I found your Twitter just because it was all of the niche things I loved. It was humor and literature and wonder and joy at life. And so I think I just started following you. And then eventually, I don't know actually which one of us followed each other first. Do you remember?
I have no idea. I just noticed that at one point I was scrolling through your account and you were tweeting about beauty and the glory of the world and finding God in poetry. And I thought, this person sounds amazing.
Well, that's about how I felt about you. And I think I was thinking about it. I think I've been following you since the spring of 2016. Mm-hmm. So we've been vaguely knowing of each other for 3 years. But yesterday we met in real life.
For the first time.
For the first time. And we drank 2 cups of tea. We ate tarts. We talked a lot.
A lot.
So this is kind of an auspicious occasion.
Hopefully the first of many.
Yes, I hope so indeed. And I asked Bose to do, we actually done one podcast together, which we were trying to describe to someone what it was about. And we were
over
just,
Skype.
Oh yeah, we did it over Skype. And we just kind of rambled about books that we liked.
Didn't we just talked about Chesterton mostly.
Yes. And but when I was thinking about the podcast that I wanted to do for friendship as we release Girls Club into the world, which is the book that I just wrote. And Bose is actually here at the conference.
For the Girls Club conference.
Yes. So Bose is
helping out.
He's helping out. He helped straighten all the books today. And I was sharing some of my favorite picture books with him. And he's in a sea of enthusiastic women. But he seems to be doing all right. But when I was thinking about kind of the ideas that I wanted to get across with friendship, I thought, I want to do one on the bond that literature, that a shared love of beautiful things, of ideas, and even kind of a vocation can create friendship. Because we're kind of unlikely friends, not well, I think we're very likely friends, but that we discovered each other and became friends, bonded around these similar ideas. What would you say, we've talked about how Dickens was a similar love of ours, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of one of the things that started bonding us. Would you say that? What were some of the other things?
Dickens, we're both Chesterton fanatics.
Yes.
We both love the Inklings. We're both, are or were, huge fans of Lord of the Rings.
Yes. Oh, are. That's not a past tense thing. Is it for you?
I wanted to make sure. I don't want to assume that you're still a Lord of the Rings fan. But we love all the mid-20th century Christian writers. We consider ourselves Christian humanists, which if you don't know what that is,
look it up.
Christians who believe in the humanities and think that art and literature is important. So mm-hmm. If you are a Christian who loves the humanities, that's what you are, even if you are unaware.
Surprise. welcome to our...
Welcome to Christian Humanism.
So we were bonded around all these, I think, two things. For me, it was a common love of all these things. Mm-hmm. And then both of us kind of have a sense of purpose, too. I mean, I feel that...
A shared vocation, as it were.
Yes. And there's this wonderful quote in The Four Loves by Lewis, where he says that friendship must be about something, even if it is just a love of cards or something else. That it's not just about going to someone and saying, be my friend. There's a sense that what draws us together becomes the foundation of friendship. And that's why we thought we would talk about a famous friendship in history that was similarly bonded around a love of these things and a shared vocation, which is about...
The friendship between C.S. Lewis and Jean Ronald Reuel Tolkien.
Have you seen that joke... tweet that says that J.R.R. Tolkien's name is really Jolkin. What is it? Jolkin, Rolkin, Tolkien. I don't know. Anyway, but that's what we're going to talk about. And we're going to talk about their lives, what beauty and productivity came for their friendship, the things that drew them together, the things that were different about them. And we just wanted to discuss that and to inspire you to seek friends who are of similar soul, who love beautiful things, to find something around which your friendship can be. So, Bose, shall we just start talking about the Inklings?
Yes.
I think that's good. So you just read a biography on the Inklings, and I have indulged in that several times. So why don't you give us a little bit of a background on Tolkien and Lewis before they came to each other?
So Lewis and Tolkien, for those of you who don't know this, first of all, Lewis wasn't always a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And before he'd written the Narnia books, before Tolkien had written The Hobbit even, Tolkien was a professor at Magdalen College
mm-hmm.
in the 1930s. This was shortly after the World War, which was for Tolkien a traumatizing experience. And Lewis he also became a professor at Magdalen College. And this is in Oxford. Mm-hmm. This is in Oxford College. Mm-hmm. And
Oxford, for those who don't know, there's Oxford University, but then mm-hmm. there's, I don't actually know how many, but there's dozens of
smaller colleges.
So you would get into Oxford University and then you would have your college, which was where you lived and worked and stuff. So,
and they were by fortuitous chance put in the same one. And people thought he was sort of this weird clownish figure.
Well, and I've read things, it said that he was very friendly, but he was a little brusque, and they said that no matter what he wore, whether it was brand new off the rack and perfectly made to suit him, he always looked a little bit like an unmade bed.
Yeah, well, that's because he always bought things that were several sizes too large. Lewis did not know how to dress himself. I don't know what that was about. But Lewis was also incredibly lonely. What's interesting is that he, too, was an orphan. His mother had died of some sickness at the age of 9. And that was around the time that he started reading literature, almost as an escape from the harsh world in which his mother no longer existed. And he decided early on, before he was a teenager, that he was an atheist, because he didn't have any particular disdain for Christianity, but he felt like the science of creation was sufficient to explain why everything came to be without God.
Mm.
He felt this intense desire for friendship with other males,
mm-hmm.
this camaraderie, because he'd gone to a boarding school. It had not gone well. And
it was terrible. It's like reading Jane Eyre or like the Dickens, the terrible conditions where they kind of... He called his own schoolmaster a sadist, like unironically. So it was terrible for him, yeah.
Lewis had almost this sort of Dickensian life because he was orphaned and then he went to the boarding school of horrors
mm-hmm.
and then he was in the war. But he actually thought his experience in boarding school was worse than being in the trenches in World War I, which only lasted a few months for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he got to college and he wrote in his diary that he despaired of ever having real friendships again because he'd had friends in the trenches, some of whom had died, and he had friends at school, but he did not have friends now. And he said, I worry that no man makes real friends after he has passed the undergraduate age.
Mm.
And he said, I would like to find people who share similar passion for the things that I care about. Mm-hmm. And what he was interested in was Anglo-Saxon poetry, which is hard to find friends who care about that. Probably easier at Oxford. And he had this achingly sad line. He said, "Oh, for the people who speak one's own language."
Mm. So Tolkien and Lewis, I think, met because they're both in the faculty, right? Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this last night, but their first meeting was not very auspicious.
Right.
So
tell us about that.
I will tell you about that just because I found this so amusing. And Lewis kept very detailed diaries. I don't know if Tolkien did as much. I feel like we have more things of letters from him. But Lewis kept very detailed diaries. Mm-hmm. And right after he met Tolkien, it says they first met at a Merton College English faculty meeting. Lewis wrote in his diary that Tolkien was a smooth, pale, fluent little chap, and that there was no harm in him, only needs a smack or so.
Not exactly complimentary.
No. Apparently Lewis's impression of Tolkien was not overall negative, but it was not very, very positive. But they became friends because
they joined forces to change the curriculum at the college. Mm-hmm. And some of you are going to get really mad about this, but they despised all literature written after Chaucer. So from 1300 to 1920.
So they convinced Oxford to not have anything past 1320 in the English curriculum, which is just unfathomable to us today.
They hated Shakespeare. They hated Dickens.
Which we're kind of mad about because I love Shakespeare and I really love Dickens.
Really love Dickens.
Yeah. So we were discussing, I don't think I would agree with that move personally.
No, I don't know if I could have been friends with Lewis and Tolkien. They sound kind of insufferable sometimes.
I know. There are moments where I love Lewis and Tolkien, but you also realize that they come very much from their own time, where they were raised.
They were of their generation.
Yes. So they joined forces over that. But then Tolkien initiated I think it was an Icelandic saga reading group. Is that right?
They were actually learning old Icelandic. He was teaching the entire staff to speak it because that was apparently a popular thing that the men wanted to do.
For whatever reason. It's interesting because when I was a visiting student at Oxford, I could take whatever, I could sit in whatever courses I wanted to. And still in the English faculty library, there's a big bust of Tolkien, mm-hmm. and they have courses in Icelandic sagas and Norse, but he's still very much this kind of mythic figure because he brought so much to the department. But they started having this reading group that Tolkien initiated, right? And I think that I was reading Bandersnatch by Diana Glier. Their kind of initiation into friendship was, I think, when Tolkien offered Lewis a little bit of his verse, and it was kind of, tell me if I'm wrong, if you're remembering this as well, but it was like the beginning poetry that would form, mm-hmm. That would form the myth behind Lord of the Rings.
At this point, Tolkien had not yet written The Hobbit, but
which Lewis kind of motivated him to write.
Yes.
But that comes later.
But he had started working on what would become, after he died, the Silmarillion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, very cautiously, because Tolkien was an intensely reserved private man who hadn't shown his writing to anyone because he didn't know if it was any good and he didn't want anyone else reading it. But he came out of himself enough to show Lewis some excerpts from the Silmarillion. And Lewis, in his extremely C.S. Lewis way,
mm-hmm.
he actually rewrote some passages that were in verse to sound more like how C.S. Lewis would write them. In this very 19th century sing-song poetic fashion. And
some of Lewis's poetry is good, but a lot of it just sounds like you could march to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like Rudyard Kipling.
Yeah.
Just rubbishy. And a good writer, not a great poet. And he was always trying to get his verses published, and nobody wanted to publish them. But there was another time when Tolkien gave him some prose to read, and Lewis spent the entire night annotating it as if he was a university scholar annotating a work written in a different language. And he added these notes saying, "I think the translator actually intended it to say this and this." And Tolkien was very amused.
very amused. And again, it's when you read these things, you go, wow, you were definitely of a particular generation. And just to think of like the knowledge you would have to begin with of
they were brilliant
people. Academic work, that they could do this for sport, for fun. So their Icelandic reading group, which Tolkien kind of began, eventually began to form into, I think it was bi-weekly meetings at first. So they would meet two times a week. And then this became, over time, I'm totally just rushing past, what would become known as the Inklings.
It started out as a series of ad hoc groups among the staff with different names. At one point, they were called the Oyster Club, and they would meet at the end of the semester to celebrate the end of the semester, and they would eat oysters together. And
that always seems like a dangerous endeavor to me.
Yeah, I'm glad that they eventually abandoned that practice and just became the Inklings. And there was a period of 4, 5, 6 years in the late 30s before the war when the faculty, many of whom would become famous just for being in this group, people like Hugo Dyson and Charles Williams mm-hmm. and Owen Barfield, they would meet once or twice a week, and they would read Beowulf together, they would drink draft cider, they would eat boiled eggs, and they would go on village hikes carrying pots of tea with them. And at each inn in the village, they'd walk 7-8 miles, they'd stop at every single inn and have a pot of tea. And this could go on for the entire evening. And while on these hikes, they would talk about again, Anglo-Saxon poetry, or they would get into these intense discussions about theology and mythology and the connections between them. They talk about religion. Mm-hmm. And Lewis started out being very combative and intensely rigorous and logical, and he'd want to argue the point with everyone. But as he got to know everyone better, he sort of became more withdrawn and was more mm-hmm. of a listener and sort of ceded ground to the others. And Tolkien actually began opening up more about his religious faith, and that is when something mm-hmm. remarkably memorable happened.
So I will put my oar in here for a moment to say that so when we were talking about, you know, what was it that drew these people together, obviously the weird kind of thing that seems to have bonded them to begin with was this interest in Anglo-Saxon poetry and Icelandic or Norse mythology. And that was actually the gateway into their conversations about Christianity. Because something that's really interesting about Norse and Icelandic mythology is that when Christianity came to Iceland, in which it was about 1,000, I just forgot, 1,000 now, you know, 1,000 years ago, they didn't do away with pagan myth. They saw Christianity as the fulfillment of it. So if they had all of these kind of, you know, like the Norse gods, when you think about Thor and you think about all these different ideas, they didn't see Christ as like, this is totally different. They saw it as though God had prepared their hearts and prepared their countries with all these myths, with all these stories, and that Christ was the fulfillment. And so in a lot of the, I did this wonderful class when I was at Oxford on Icelandic myth, and we looked at how in this era, it's just burgeoning with new myths after Christianity came, because they would tell stories in light of Christ, that they would say this is the fulfillment, and it changed things. So where their stories used to be, I mean, they were always violent, but there became these codes, and there became the idea that the good thing was to be a sacrificial hero, not to be the conquering violent hero. And so this was a really common theme in Norse and in Icelandic literature. And Lewis, when he was a child and he read myth, he talks about this in Surprised by Joy, that when he read the stories of Norse mythology, it awakened what he would call joy later. It was this desire that nothing in the world could satisfy. And so Tolkien, who was a very devout Catholic, his mother had converted to Catholicism, and then when she died, she left Tolkien and his brother? Does Tolkien have a brother, or am I making that up?
I think he did, yes.
I thought for a moment I was making that up, but I think Lewis and Tolkien both had one brother, to a priest, because she was worried that her family wouldn't raise him in the faith. So Tolkien was a very devout Catholic, and he was he loved that. It was a part of his life and his tradition, and he saw his studying Norse mythology as having this inherent connection with Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so he began to kind of
work on Lewis.
He said, you love myth. It appeals, you talk about it like it's the most profound thing in your life. He said, but what if there was a true myth? What if Christ was not only a myth, but was the myth that had become fact, as Lewis later put it? And so he worked and worked on them. And then I'll tell this. Do you want to tell the story of Addison's walk? And then I'll tell my personal story about it.
Well, I should add that Lewis was sort of opposed to Christianity, not just on intellectual grounds, but also aesthetic grounds, because mm-hmm. he thought that the Norse stories were more interesting than the Gospels. He had sort of this intellectual pride because he felt, I don't get the same sense of joy reading about these mundane happenings 2,000 years ago that I get when I'm reading about Loki and Thor and Odin. Mm. I don't feel this deep welling up of wonder inside of me because it's not myth. He said, I'm pretty close to believing that everything in the Gospels actually happened, but why should I care? Mm. I like mythology. I don't care about history. And so they went on this, what became a very famous walk, Addison's walk, and Tolkien said something that profoundly changed Lewis's life.
So basically, they had this walk, and pretty much what I just kind of accounted for, the idea that Christianity was the myth that became fact, that all of these stories find resonance in us because they're deeply human and because they reflect God's relationship with humanity. And so he began to convince Lewis that this was true, that Christianity was the myth that had become human, that Jesus was the fulfillment of all the longing and desire.
And Lewis would later write in his diary, he said, they had been talking for about 2 hours, and Tolkien turned to him and said, the Gospels are a myth. They just happen to be a myth that has come true. And Lewis said that when Tolkien said that, they were walking over a bridge, and there were trees overhanging the bridge, and at the moment he said that, a shower of leaves came falling down like rain, and he said it was one of the most magical moments of his life.
Oh, that's amazing. And the fun thing to me is this is a very personal connection, because Addison's walk, which is where they walked, so you said earlier that Lewis was a fellow at, if you're in England, you'd say Magdalen, because they just like combine it, but for Americans, we'd say Magdalen or Magdalen College. So he was a fellow there, so he had rooms, and then if you just walk down the pathway from where his rooms were, which is where they'd often have Inklings meetings later, there's a deer park that it's literally exactly what it sounds like. It's a park where they keep a whole bunch of deer, and there's a big circular walk that you can walk around. So supposedly they just walked around it. The thing is, to walk around it for several hours, you'd have to walk around it like probably 6 or 7 times, because it's not that big. But from what I remember in, I think he talks about Surprise of Joy, he basically said that he came away from that night believing in God. And it would take a long time before he would like officially kind of call himself a Christian. And
he called himself the most reluctant convert in all of England.
And but what's special to me is that you can still get into that deer park. It's called Addison's Walk. In Magdalen College, if you go in, I think it's like 2 to 4 on any weekday. And so since I've lived in the UK, I've visited the deer park at least once every year. And I always kind of go there with the intention to like think and pray about life, because it's just kind of a special place, and you can walk around it once and it gives you kind of a you know. And the last time I was there, I told Bose about this last night. I was yet again thinking and praying about my life, and there was kind of a big decision I had to make. And I was walking by myself, and so there's always all of these deer, because that's what the deer park is. I all of a sudden saw this completely white stag, like white in its antlers to its toes. Mm. And I looked around to see if anyone was there to like corroborate the fact that I had seen this white stag, because I thought, this is almost like a fairy tale. This is like a dream or a vision.
I didn't even know that white stags really existed. I thought it was just a Narnia thing.
I did too. And later on, one of my other friends, who's a photographer, took a picture of it. And he was like, yes, there was a white stag, which I was almost disappointed by, because I kind of wanted myself to be the only person who'd ever seen it. And that'd be my vision that answered my... Mm-hmm. It didn't really answer my prayer, because it was more of like a decision thing.
But it was inspiring.
It was very inspiring. So that's an aside. I was trying to find a passage from Myth Became Fact, which is this little tiny essay that Lewis wrote. I think it's really indicative, really, of what Tolkien shared with him. And he says, as myth transcends thought, so incarnation transcends myth. The heart of Christianity is a myth which also is a fact.
The old myth of the dying god, without ceasing to be myth, comes down from heaven of legend and imagination to the earth of history. It happens at a particular date, in a particular place, followed by definable historical consequences. We passed from Balder or Osiris, dying nobody knows when or where, to a historical person, crucified. It is all in order under Pontius Pilate. But by becoming fact, it does not cease to be myth. That is the miracle. I suspect that men have sometimes derived more spiritual substance from myths which they did not believe than the religion they professed. To truly be a Christian, we must both assent to the historical fact and receive the myth, fact though it has become, with the same imaginative embrace which we accord all myths. The one is hardly more necessary than the other. Mm-hmm. Isn't that beautiful? And that's, it's kind of amazing to see this in Lewis's writing, because I think he received that idea mm-hmm. from Tolkien.
It comes up again and again.
Yeah, it comes up and again and again. So Lewis became a Christian eventually, and there was always a bit of tension because he was
Anglican,
and he got more Catholic the older he got, but he never completely crossed, he never crossed the Tiber, as they say. Mm-hmm. But he became a Christian. So then they had this shared, they had the shared love of literature, they had a shared vocation, and then they had this shared spiritual, religious faith and experience.
So for a few years, for about a decade, they had a profoundly close friendship because they were not only professors of literature before 1300, they also had an intense spiritual friendship based upon their celebration of the myth that became fact, the incarnation, the Christian story. And Tolkien would later write this really lovely statement about him. This was years after their friendship. Looking back on it, he said, "My friendship with Lewis, besides giving constant pleasure and comfort, has done me much good from the contact with a man at once honest, brave, intellectual, a scholar, a poet, a philosopher, and a lover, at least after a long pilgrimage, of our Lord."
Oh, that gives me chills almost. It's such a beautiful thing. And I think what's also amazing, just like on a practical note, so their, I think their friendship kind of formed the gravitational center mm-hmm. of the Inklings.
For sure.
And I, in Bandersnatch, said that their writing group was the most prolific writing group of the 20th century. So they produced the most work of any other kind of like friendship between writers.
Not surprising when you think about it.
It is. Well, and it is surprising, but I think it's this picture of the fruit and satisfaction and happiness and delight, but also the great work that can be done that comes from this companionship and this friendship mm-hmm. together. Some of the other authors were Charles Williams, who, it's funny, everyone in the Inklings seems to have thought of him as like far and away the most thoughtful writer, but people don't really remember Charles Williams as well.
I think he's coming back.
You think so?
I think we're in a weird age, and mm-hmm. Charles Williams is a weird man who is ideally suited to our times. This yeah. guy, I spent a long time reading about him last night. He had this fantastical imagination. He said he was walking through the city of London, and it felt like a grand theme park with its churches, law courts, libraries, printing presses. He said, "The city of London to me is an image of the city of God." And he performed magic.
Also, Lewis was kind of a fanboy of Williams. So, like, before he came to the Inklings.
Before they met,
Lewis, like, wrote him, like, fan letters.
They were reading each other's books at the same time and didn't know it. And they mm-hmm. wrote letters to each other that crossed in the mail by a fortuitous chance.
So, basically, this friendship between Lewis and Tolkien then became this friendship that kind of invited other people into their circle. There's a great part in The Four Loves where Lewis basically says that friendship, unlike romantic love, is always open to inviting other people into it. Mm. And that it can't really be called friendship if it's not that way. And it was incredibly prolific. Something I want to point out that I think is really interesting to me is that I think that Tolkien, though he was deeply introverted and deeply sensitive, probably the most, I think, of the group.
For sure.
And he had we'll talk about this in a minute. He had a tendency to occasionally get a little bit hurt by Lewis because Lewis was brusque and full and whatever.
Which led to friction in their later years.
Yes, which I think we should talk about in a minute. But Tolkien, even though he was the most introverted and most sensitive, I think was kind of this conduit of friendship. Because even before he started Inklings, when he was in secondary school or high school, mm-hmm. as we'd say it, he created the Tea Cake and Barovian Society. I think that was what it was called. And this was like this kind of pre-Inklings club that mm-hmm. he had with his high school friends. And with them, he had this vision of like, we need to re-enchant the world with myth. And he was very motivated. And then they all went to college. And he got kind of mad at them because he felt like they weren't taking their calling seriously mm-hmm. enough. And they all bonded together. And over one weekend before they all went off to the war and kind of wrote this manifesto of what they thought their work would be in the world. And very sadly, two of the three of his best friends died in the war. But I think that kind of...
Motivated him
to seek out that again. And we were talking about how Lewis and Tolkien have these similarities. They're both orphans. They're both lonely. Mm-hmm. But Tolkien, even in his very introverted, very sensitive self, was kind of this center of friendship.
A hub.
People kind of orbited around him.
When you read about Tolkien, you get the sense that although he was very dry and pedantic, he was somehow this weirdly charismatic figure that inspired a sense of awe with everyone he met.
Yeah.
They all speak of him in the most glowing, reverent terms.
I love reading the things they say about each other, because I would love for a friend to feel that close and to have that admiration. Mm-hmm. It's just a kind of beautiful mutual respect. But I feel like we should talk a bit about some of their differences, because I think the reality is that even though they were very close, they created these prolific relationships, they were still humans, and they still mm-hmm. had personality quirks and differences. So what were some of those?
Well, there was the religion for one thing, because although Lewis seems like he almost wanted to be Catholic at times, mm-hmm. he could never quite make that jump. And Tolkien was very adamant that while he felt that Lewis was a genuine Christian, he still would have liked for him to become mm-hmm. a Catholic like he was.
Well, and I read, I can't remember who told me this, it might have been Michael Ward, he said that Tolkien always felt a bit... like he was an altar boy caught with his fingers in the holy water by Lewis.
What does that mean?
That Lewis, especially near the beginning, almost kind of teased him for his piety and his real, like... He was raised in Catholic faith. He was very, you know, that was very part of his life. And Tolkien was so not that he almost took it a little bit lightly and thought it was a little superstitious at first.
Yeah, there was some friction because Lewis teased him about his Catholicism, mm-hmm. especially at first, and mm-hmm. Tolkien felt there was some snobbery in it.
Mm-hmm. Especially in England, because
Catholics are seen as on a lower scale.
Well, and Catholicism was, like, not legal, or they were literally, for a long time, and they were seen as, you know, you had the recusants who were literally kind of pushed into a lower class mm-hmm. of society. So that was still very prevalent in their minds. Kind of snobbery.
And they had to work through that. But also their methods of writing were wildly different, which I'm sure you've noticed if you've read Narnia and Lord mm-hmm. of the Rings. Tolkien's writing is richer, fuller. He thought through everything. He
wanted there to be a world.
He overthought. He would draft things. He would spend years drafting.
Years and years.
And revising. Whereas Lewis was weirdly prolific. His first book, Pilgrim's Regress, he wrote within a fortnight. And he wrote most of the Narnia books within a week and did not revise them. He would just write them and send them off to be published, and they'd be published.
Isn't that insane?
And I think that probably inspired some jealousy in Tolkien. But also, Tolkien was sort of irritated with Lewis's helter-skelter
method of writing.
Yeah, he didn't take his craft seriously, according to Tolkien. And his verse was pastiche, and his fantasy stories were a weird, disjointed, and not coherent hodgepodge of a bunch of different mythologies. Mm-hmm. And Tolkien felt like there had to be some kind of unity to it, some unifying theory, which there wasn't. Lewis was just writing whatever came to his mind.
Well, and it's, I mean, which is honestly kind of amazing when you think about the fact that, as a reader now, I could think he just sat down and wrote the Narnia books. But it's also interesting because Tolkien was very slow. He would write things over and over again, and he didn't plot things out ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So Lewis would sit down and just kind of birth forth a book with its entirety, with its plot, with its everything. Tolkien would kind of write as he went and not know what was going to happen. So famously, like, you know, when he was writing Lord of the Rings,
He wrote several versions in which one, Strider, you know, who we know as the great Aragorn, the king of the new city,
was a hobbit with a peg leg.
A hobbit with a peg leg. He hadn't decided. And then...
honestly, that would have been cooler.
I mean, you know, it would have been pretty neat. I don't know. I love Aragorn. He's like, he's such a good hero. But imagine if... I mean, in one, he didn't even have in his mind that Aragorn was going to be this character, which is just crazy. And Lewis, on the other hand, would just sit down and go, it's all in my head now, it's on the paper, and knew all of it to begin with. But, and it wasn't just that this was different. This caused some, like, they were kind of critical of each other. Like, Lewis kind of saw Tolkien as creatively constipated, that he just couldn't get out what he was going to get out, and he wasn't just going to write forth his work. And Tolkien kind of saw Lewis as flippantly just doing this stuff very quickly.
He didn't hate the Narnia books, but he definitely didn't feel as enthusiastic as Lewis wanted him to.
And, you know, for the kindness, people are always depicting it as though, like, Tolkien, like, left Lewis as a friend because he didn't like the Narnia books. He did give children, Tolkien would give children the Narnia books for Christmas. So he didn't entirely hate them, but he did feel that it was a bit, you know, a bit hodgepodge. And then, of course, there was kind of the... so we said they were Protestant and Catholic. Craftsman versus pastiche.
The marriage caused some friction between them.
Oh, to Joy? Yeah. Wasn't that because...
she was a divorcee.
Yes, she was a divorcee, and Tolkien was very against that. Mm-hmm. And I've heard she was also quite a character. Like, she was very... she was a very strong personality, and...
it's actually a good movie about their relationship, Shadowlands, if you ever...
yeah, it's beautiful. It's very heartbreaking. I've heard that there's some historical things. There's also a book that recently came out about her, I think. Oh. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes. But yeah, so they had these little kind of tiffs throughout their life where they would kind of irritate each other. And then also Tolkien, I think, felt a bit overshadowed by Charles Williams when he entered the Inklings. And
it's hard not to be overshadowed by Charles Williams. He was a magnetic... wild, flamboyant, eccentric.
Yeah, who everyone seems to just love. But then Charles Williams died shortly after the war, mm-hmm. and that, I think, kind of shocked the Inklings. And I think in the end, Tolkien eventually kind of forgave Lewis for that departure. Yeah, it's just kind of amazing to see their lives and to see how, in many ways, how similar they were. You know, that they had these shared interests and this shared vocation, this shared... love of things, and then eventually this shared faith. But then that they also had all these...
they weren't always best friends, but they remained close.
And they were the cause of such good things, so many good things in each other's lives. Tolkien kind of said that if Lewis hadn't pushed him, he may not have written The Hobbit. And then if he hadn't written The Hobbit, he wouldn't have written probably Lord of the Rings, or at least it wouldn't have been published.
And Lewis was his biggest champion for years. He would review all his books in the Times Literary Supplement. And with glowing reviews. And so people, they were brought to the attention of the world through Lewis's reviews.
That's something that I love about the Inklings. And Diana Glyer talks about this a lot in Bandersnatch. They were all each other's advocates. So they would give each other good reviews. They would recommend each other to their publishers. They kind of felt like they had this common goal to release not just good literature, but literature that brought hope and that brought...
enchantment
into the world. And so they saw that as kind of this common vocation, this common mission, and they did it with each other. And I think that's part of the beauty to me of their friendship, was that it wasn't just about them, it was about what their friendship and their love and their companionship created. I feel like we could just talk about Inklings until the sun goes down, until doomsday. We should just do like a 5-hour podcast and then we'll just turn it into 5 different parts. But I thought I would ask Bose, now we've kind of given this story, what for you do you think are some of the takeaways from looking at their friendship and their life about what it would look like for us to cultivate, to seek, to pursue friendships that are meaningful, that are lasting, and that are fruitful? You know what I mean? Because they were so, they both were satisfactions to each other's loneliness. But they were also these kind of advocates, and they produced so much good work because of being friends together. So what are some of the takeaways from their story for you?
There's something really meaningful about a friendship that is built around something higher than the friendship itself.
Yes.
They weren't just friends for the sake of being friends. They were always united by something more, whether it was poetry, Old Norse poetry, Old Anglo-Saxon poetry, or whether it was their religious faith. And so the friendship wasn't an end to itself, it was directed towards something.
And I think that's a really important thing, because I was just talking with my sister about how when we approach friendships just for the sake of each other, it can actually kind of crush the friendship, because it's like you're looking to someone to fulfill these great needs just unto themselves. And none of us are meant to be able to do that entirely for each other.
Mm-hmm.
But when you have something else that you're looking to, it becomes less of the selfish thing and more of this enjoyment, this companionship, but also something that produces something good and beautiful. And it's not just the curving in on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I think I would tell people, seek people who you can have friendships about something.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we have that in a way.
For sure.
Yes, we've agreed that we have similar...
Weirdly similar tastes,
which is half the fun of Twitter. We were joking today about how you can make a joke about, you know, Attic Wives or Lady Catherine de Bourgh, and people will laugh at it and retweet it, which is a strange thing about Twitter.
Still so bizarre to me that people even know who Lady Catherine de Bourgh is, but...
But they do.
I don't mind.
I know, I don't mind either. So I think seeking people have similar interests, but then also those deeper things, that oftentimes those interests drive you into a deeper knowledge of... whether it's a sense of vocation or your faith, seek things to have friendships around. And I think what was so beautiful about their friendship was this sense that they were surrounded by people that they admired and enjoyed. And so today we're going to close with a quote from The Four Loves, which is Lewis's book on different kinds of love. One of the main, which he talks about, is friendship. And so Bozen and I are going to read this quote to close us off today. Thank you all very much for listening.
In a perfect friendship, this appreciative love is, I think, often so great and so firmly based that each member of the circle feels in his secret heart humbled before the rest. Sometimes he wonders what he is doing there among his betters. He is lucky beyond desert to be in such company, especially when the whole group is together, each bringing out all that is best, wisest, or funniest in all the others.
Those are the golden sessions, when four or five of us, after a hard day's walk, have come to our inn, when our slippers are on, our feet spread out toward the blades, and our drinks at our elbows, when the whole world and something beyond the world opens itself to our minds as we talk, and no one has any claim on or any responsibility for another, but all are free men and equals, as if we had first met an hour ago, while at the same time an affection mellowed by the years enfolds us. Life, natural life, has no better gift to give. Who could have deserved it?
Thank you for listening to this special Girls Club episode of Speaking with Joy. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please leave a rating and review on iTunes. And don't forget to purchase your copy of Girls Club anywhere books are sold.